As he prepared to leave Mount Vernon in April 1789 to journey to his inauguration in New York City, George Washington dashed off letters to his closest friends and relatives. Washington had not sought the presidency. After 35 years of intermittent warfare, he preferred to live and die on his own plantation. To Henry Knox, his Revolutionary War comrade in arms, he wrote, "My movements to the chair of government will be accompanied with feelings not unlike those of a culprit who is going to the place of execution. I greatly apprehend that my countrymen will expect too much from me." Like many Americans, half a dozen years after the war, Washington was scraping by financially. For his 8 years as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army, he had received neither salary nor pension, only reimbursement for well-documented expenses. He had been forced to neglect his farms, the principal source of his income. In all, the war had diminished Washington's net worth by half, and he had met with little success in recouping his fortune. Britain's high-handed post-war restrictions on American trade had eliminated the primary Caribbean markets for Washington's crops, while pre-war Mediterranean markets for his wheat were falling prey to North African privateers. A post-war depression had dried up cash and credit nationwide. Some tenants on Washington's frontier farms could no longer pay their rent, forcing him to take them to court and evict them. To George Augustine Washington, his favorite nephew, Washington confided, "Necessity, if this election had not happened, would have forced me into frugality, as my means are not adequate to the expense at which I have lived since my retirement to what is called private life." Once inaugurated, he would receive a yearly salary of $25,000, approximately $750,000 today, the highest in the United States at the time. Clearly, George Washington needed the job. In that era of unparalleled change, Washington, like the other founders of the new republic, made major decisions that were influenced by his personal financial circumstances. In 1776, as they lined up in Philadelphia to sign the Declaration of Independence, the founders attested quite literally to its final words, "We pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." If defeated, they would, as Benjamin Franklin put it, most assuredly all hang separately, forfeiting their fortunes and their lives, probably in the gruesome execution ritual the English reserved for traitors, hanging, drawing, and quartering. But what exactly were their fortunes? What impact would they have on critical political decisions and the formative policies of incipient institutions? What, if any, were the lingering consequences? By examining the financial affairs of the founders and the unprecedented decisions they made to shape a new nation, this book attempts to answer these important, timely, and virtually unexplored questions, making the founders' finances much more evident while explaining that, well aware of the high stakes, they did not necessarily expect commensurate rewards. A little over a century ago, Columbia University professor Charles A. Beard rocked the foundations of normally staid and hagiographic American history by rejecting what he called the juristic theory of the origin and nature of the Constitution. He supplanted it with this hypothesis, that economic elements were the chief factors in the development of the nation's political institutions. In his 1913 book, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States, Professor Beard argued that economic forces underlay the movement for the formation and adoption of the federal Constitution and determined its most important provisions. Launching the progressive school of American history, Beard asserted that substantially all of the merchants, moneylenders, security holders, manufacturers, shippers, capitalists, and financiers, and their professional associates supported the Constitution, while any opposition came from unrepresented non-slaveholding farmers and debtors. Beard concluded that the new Constitution was not the product of the whole people, but of economic interests who expected to benefit from it.